I know Jim put in his note that he did not screw up the recording, which sounds like a challenge to me. So don't you screw up the recording. So, all right. I am hereby challenged. All right. So first, before I start, anybody have any administrative questions? Everybody knows this is the last session of this term. If you're staying on track, a fine time to turn in your audio for certification, but you do have a few years left. And I have a feeling, as we look at our finances, I have a feeling those years will be later and later, because I'm not sure we're going anywhere. If you haven't, if you're paying by the term, you'll get tuition invoice. Everybody, pretty clear?
Yep.
Okay. This afternoon I'm going to talk about social anxiety disorder, and I will goof up and call it social phobia at times because it's so hard when you have years and years with one terminology and then a new DSM comes out. So if I call it social phobia, I'm really talking about social anxiety disorder, and I'm just going to show a video of a few people describing what it's like for them. I like it because it's from Australia and I love the accent. What can I say?
Just what it's like to be me is, so here I am, I'm on planet Earth, I look around, I see other human beings, and they are doing things that I want to do. Having relationships, they're happy, they're in families. And I'm trapped here in this body, and I can't do any of those things. Now that I'm further on in recovery, I am doing some of those things, but for 30, 40 years of my life, I felt that a cruel joke had been played on me, and that I was trapped in this body, which looks perfectly fine to everybody, but in actual fact that I was extremely disabled.
If you can imagine being in a constant state of fear, constant state of panic, rapid breathing, incredible muscle tension, feelings of disassociation, which means to me a feeling of not really being connected or in touch with your true feelings. The whole thing is just difficult to explain, but it's very demanding in terms of energy.
It's very, very hard for people to understand what you're going through until they're actually in your situation, because it's really terrifying. You go shopping, and shopping is so simple to people that don't have social phobia, but actually somebody that does, it's the biggest, biggest task. Like, it used to wear me out. I used to go and do it and come home and I'd be exhausted, a headache, a cigarette after cigarette, cups of coffee, and just horrible.
Well, social phobia is an anxiety.
Thank you, we don't need that. Okay. All right, so some people telling you a little bit of their story. And we have in the handout the DSM-5 criteria. Wait, we do.
Page 14.
14.
Oh, yeah, right. One of the changes with DSM-5 is it used to be that you could have social phobia with, and it could be generalized or specific. Okay, and so the these people are pretty much the generalized, it's encompassing their life. It could be very specific to, say, performance anxiety or public speaking. Now the difference is that it's all social anxiety disorder, but you would specify if it's performance only. So, and the picture is quite different from people who are so so anxious about being in social situations that it's incapacitating or affecting every aspect of their life, and people who are just afraid to speak in public. So it makes sense to have a separate specification. And you want to, when you're looking at assessment, you need to differentiate from panic and from things like paranoia. And I've seen a number of patients who have been diagnosed as paranoid, because what they'll say is they'll say, you know, I think everybody's watching me. And so they'll get diagnosed as paranoid. The key in distinguishing that is you want to look for, is there malicious intent? I mean, do they think people are going to hurt them? Or are they just acutely self-conscious? People with social anxiety disorder are very self-conscious, and they think that everyone is going to notice every single thing. But there's no harm intended. They just are concerned. And the big concern, the big factor that differentiates it from the other anxiety disorders is that the key fear is the fear of negative evaluation. People are afraid that they'll be judged by other people, they'll be embarrassed or humiliated. So you gotta get the details of what's going on in their cognitions, because what can look very similar, so someone with social anxiety disorder might be uncomfortable going shopping. But if you just look at they're afraid to go out in public, you could diagnose them as agoraphobic. And the difference is with agoraphobia, the person's afraid of having a panic attack. Whereas with social anxiety disorder, they're afraid of that negative evaluation or embarrassment. And it's tricky. You got to get those specifics, because if you just look at where they go and what they do, it doesn't tell you enough. You have to get what about. So if you go out in public, what could happen? You know, what are you afraid of happening? You also need to assess social skills deficits. Not everyone with a social anxiety disorder has social skills deficits, and some have huge social skills deficits. Social anxiety disorder tends to start in people around puberty, which is when people start getting self-conscious about what other people think. And so often that means if they've been avoiding since they were 12, they might not have developed the social skills for comfortable social interaction. But there are other people who have perfectly fine social skills in specific situations, but in high stress situations, a situation that they have defined as risky, that they'll be embarrassed or humiliated, they get very, very anxious. So you can't assume that everyone with social anxiety disorder has social skills deficits, but you want to assess that, because if they do, then that can be an important part of the treatment. Yes?
So if a person with a social anxiety disorder becomes homebound of the fear of being judged by others, would that person consider as agoraphobia or no?
It's not homebound anymore. Isn't the point. That's just what, I mean, the point is what they're afraid of. Okay. So if it's all about negative evaluation, mm-hmm. and they don't have panic attacks, or they're not afraid of panic, they just think they could be humiliated or embarrassed, mm-hmm. then they could be very restricted. They're more likely to be homebound because of with agoraphobia. But, for example, you know, they might be perfectly fine going shopping in the middle of the night, which there are plenty of 24-hour stores, you know, and avoiding the social contact but still going out. So you have to get, like, have them imagine different situations and what's running through their mind, what's really upsetting to them, and what, in addition to what they're avoiding. So the key is that fear of negative evaluation. And please, a number of people in their exams, which probably, well, anyway, a number of people are acting like the cognitive triad of depression is the key to all the different disorders we're talking about. And truly, the point is, there are different cognitions that are key to each disorder. So it's not just one general triad that works for it. It's not one-stop shopping. So with a panic disorder, the person's afraid of having panic attacks and what that might mean. With social anxiety disorder, the person's afraid of how people evaluating them negatively, of feeling embarrassed or humiliated. Now, what happens is that they get, if you look at the little diagram, for these people, when you're afraid of something, if you've heard there might be a bear in the woods, you're going to be vigilant for the sounds of twigs cracking, or, you know, if you're worried about having a panic attack, you might be very vigilant to, is your heart racing, what kind of physical symptoms are you having. If you're worried about negative evaluation, like in social anxiety disorder, people are vigilant for signs of negative evaluation. So if I'm worried about how people might be judging me, I'm going to notice that somebody's fidgeting, or somebody's gets up and leaves the room, and I'm going to assume that, oh my goodness, they're, you know, evaluating me, they're bored, they're upset, you know, they're digging in, you know, a big purse, they could be getting out tomatoes to throw at me. I mean, with social interaction, if you look for signs of negative evaluation, you will find them. I mean, like, just this moment as I'm looking, nobody's smiling in this room. Oh my God, this is terrible. You know, I mean, people could yawn. It might have nothing to do with the fact that they didn't get enough sleep last night, or that it's really hard to sit here for an entire day on a weekend. But if you, really, that is the bind. It's a different category, but similar in that, if you look at your body to see if everything's functioning right, you're going to find something that feels funky. And if you look at how people are reacting to you, you're going to find negatives. And there's lots of research to show that given the exact same stimulus, people, you know, the same pictures, the same whatever is presented to the person, people with social anxiety disorder are much more likely to rate themselves as being evaluated negatively, or rate social cues as being negative ones. If you're looking for it, you're going to find it, because there's that much ambiguity. And in a take, I remember once when I was in grad school, I had a roommate. The fact that she, at the time, was Jim's girlfriend, totally irrelevant to the story. But she was interesting. So I had a roommate. We shared an apartment. Okay. Some guys knocked on the door. Some young guys knocked on the door and asked if, you know, if we had a couple eggs they could borrow. Okay. I don't think we did. We said, sorry, no, and closed the door. And she was like, she closed the door and she's like, oh, my God, I've never been so scared in my life. I'm like, really? Why? She said, well, couldn't you see? I mean, I didn't know he could be a mass murderer. I mean, it was just like total different evaluation of the situation. I strongly suspect, given what I later found out about her, that I was correct. There were some guys trying to bake a cake and forgot that they needed eggs, okay? But social cues are ambiguous, and people can take the exact same stimulus and judge it very, very differently. And social anxiety disorder patients are definitely biased towards reading other people as being negative. And so they're going to worry about, they're going to spot judgment, whether it's there or not. They're going to avoid. And the truth is, if they do have social skills deficits, which a lot of them do, because if it started when you're a teenager and you don't practice and develop the social skills, then they do come across as a little bit strange, and they can get some negative reactions. And of course, then it feeds itself and it can snowball. So you've got the vigilance to that negative evaluation, and then very sensitive. It's very important that people judge them positively, so the fear gets worse, and then they worry about anything that might result in negative evaluation. So what if I make a mistake? What if people notice that I'm anxious? It's a big one. And then they are terrified, and of course, as soon as they start avoiding, then they get less practice and the fear builds. And anytime anyone avoids anything out of anxiety, that fear just builds. So the conceptualization is pretty straightforward. So I'm going to give you three different examples of very different people who would all meet the criteria. So Marilyn was a 38-year-old business manager. She's married, had two school-age kids. She had a fear of public speaking. The data from college, she'd avoided public speaking until college. There was a required speech class. When she had to do a speech in her required class, her voice shook and her mind went blank, and it was like very, very upsetting to her. She actually had taken some Inderol with some success. We'll talk about medications in a minute. And but it was pretty limited, and you know, when you take a med so that you don't get anxious, then it becomes another type of avoidance. And so by the time she came to see me, she'd started with just being anxious about big speeches. But she was in a business setting, and she had to go to meetings and things. So it started to generalize, and it used to be speeches in front of a big group of people, then it became smaller, then it became even to the point where she got very anxious in a stressful one-on-one situation, like if she had to meet with her boss or someone, and had all kinds of physical symptoms, including her mind would go blank, and she would have trouble concentrating. So that would, but she didn't have any problem with friends and, you know, husband and kids. You know, she didn't have anxiety except in increasingly generalized social situations, business kind of work kind of situations. At least that's what she reported when she came in. Amy, and by the way, fear of public speaking, interesting. When in population studies, at least in the West, in population studies, people consistently over the years report fear of public speaking as higher percentage and higher level of fear than the fear of death. Your average person is, fear of public speaking is way up there, okay? I mean, people will rank it above the fear of death. So it's not but to become a social anxiety disorder, it has to be interfering in your life. So if everybody, you know, a lot of people have some discomfort with public speaking. But if it's not interfering with your life significantly, you wouldn't get a diagnosis. But as soon as it does, you might merit the diagnosis. Now, Amy was a 23-year-old single, gay, unemployed female. And she was uncomfortable in a wide variety of social situations. All kinds of physical symptoms, but specifically, and this is not uncommon, eating and drinking in public. Okay, so if you're drinking or eating people could notice you're anxious and your hands shake. I saw Amy so long ago, it's hard to believe. She must be getting old too. because it was back when people really had just started. I am so old, I remember when people didn't use credit cards. So it was very rare. And she was very anxious, eating and drinking in public, but also writing in public. And when credit cards started to become more common, she was terrified that she would get nervous while signing her name and people would think she was criminal, you know, that she was forging it or something. So all of a sudden, you know, the eating and drinking had been an issue, but all of a sudden there was more call to write in public and that became more of an issue. So she was avoiding a wide variety, including dates, social situations, the eating, drinking, writing, she also was a recovering alcoholic. And at that time, if you went to AA meetings and you didn't drink coffee, there was something wrong with you. I mean, at least in her opinion, you had to drink coffee. But of course, if you drink coffee and your hands shake, and what if you spill it? You could spill it on someone. It was actually interfering with her consistent recovery because she was so anxious about AA meetings. And it was specifically, the hardest part for her was the drinking in public. So that was Amy. Now, John, very different situation. You may not come across this a lot, but if you don't, I see this a fair amount, so it's possible you aren't asking. So John was a 30-year-old married man. He had a long-standing problem with being unable to urinate in public restrooms. Okay, now this is a thing. Let's face it, there's a reason why we have multiple breaks in the afternoon, right? I'm the first one in the ladies' room, okay? But, you know, my kids went to school, restrooms were not a comfortable place. That's where kids smoked and did all kinds of things they weren't supposed to do, so they could go all day without going to the bathroom. A lot of people can avoid, and John successfully avoided using public restrooms until he was in a training program to become an x-ray technician. And it wasn't one of these, it was one of these multi-day hotel things where you're in meetings and classes all day long. You don't have time to go back to your room. He was in a situation where he had to use public restrooms. Now you gotta be careful, right? Because if he was afraid of public restrooms because of the germs, what would that be?
OCD.
Yeah, that would likely be OCD. But, and I personally feel like I know more about men's restrooms than really is appropriate for, with my gender. But in many public restrooms, a lot of guys worry about, will they be able to pee? And peeing is one of those situations, like if you try it too hard to get to sleep, you won't sleep. If you are worried that the guy next to you at the urinal is going to, and often the concern is that they're going to think you're gay, because why are you out there with your penis out if you're not peeing, okay? Or they're going to think there's something wrong with you, or they're going to think you're a predator, you know? So, of course, if you go and try this guy sometime, you know, go in and convince yourself that it's terribly, terribly important that you pee right then. Right then! You're not going to have another chance to pee for, you know, your next seminar is 5 hours long. You can't leave. Try it. It's not only men. Men do are more frequent simply because of the more public nature of urinals. But women, there are plenty of women who are concerned that, oh my goodness, they're worried that the people in the other stalls will be listening, And what if they don't make the right sounds, or what if they're too noisy, or what if they'll think something sketchy is going on? I mean, things it would never occur to me to pay any attention to what was going on in the other spouse. So you tell me. John was afraid of one thing: peeing in a public restroom. Okay? Why would that be a social anxiety disorder and not a specific phobia?
Because his mindset, he's thinking what others will think of him.
Mm-hmm. He's not afraid of the situation itself. Mm-hmm. He's not afraid that something terrible that the bathroom is going to cause the problem. He's afraid of the negative evaluation. And so that's what makes the difference. If it's about what will people think, mm-hmm. then it's a social anxiety disorder. And all three, Marilyn, the public speaking lady, Amy, the young woman with eating and drinking, and John, all three met full criteria for social anxiety disorder. Yes?
What about a specific phobia? Phobia about peeing in.
Okay, a specific phobia. I mean, first of all, it's hard to imagine what a specific, I mean, if the person's afraid that, I mean, you could have a situation, say they're afraid they'll be locked in the stall, then it might be claustrophobia. I mean, I guess I don't understand your question.
I'm not that you use the example, I'm thinking even more about his phobia about peeing in the public stall.
Yeah, so what's your question? So,
is this specific phobia?
You just answered my question as to why it's a social mm-hmm. anxiety disorder. He's not afraid of the process of peeing. He's not afraid of the bathroom. Mm-hmm. He is worried about negative evaluation by other people. Okay? If the core fear is, what will people think of me? Will I be embarrassed or humiliated? It is going to be a social anxiety disorder. If the person's afraid of the actual situation, and there are, by the way, claustrophobics have a lot of trouble in small restrooms, you know. But then, again, if they're afraid to be in small stalls because if they're closed in, that's a specific phobia. But if they're afraid of negative evaluation, it's social anxiety disorder. And it is important because the treatment can, you know, if you could have him, you know, it'd be ridiculous to have John practice being in small places because restrooms, you know, might be small. That's not the point. And we'll get to the treatment in a minute. But these people would look totally different. Marilyn, Amy, and John, in terms of their presentation, what they're concerned about, but they all have social anxiety disorder. So the treatment. Okay, similar, and we're sticking with in anxiety disorders, that the key is the attitude of acceptance. And patients do not want to come in. They want the anxiety to be gone. They want to be Cary Grant. Okay? I don't know who the modern equivalent is. Who's Mr. Suave and sophisticated these days? It's hard because of...
Donald Trump.
Huh? Don't you give me that! I don't know. Who's Mr. Cool?
John Hamm.
John Hamm? I don't even know that. Well, I'll let you guys decide. And you come to a consensus and let me know so we can update our... I know Jim, when he talks about guided discovery, he uses Columbo, and really, I mean, he has no idea who Columbo is. But some people know Cary Grant because of old movies. But anyway, they want to come in, and they want to be Mr. or Ms. Cool, Calm, Collected. The idea of accepting that you might get anxious in public is, again, you've got to sell it. It doesn't come naturally. And in fact, the person, ultimately, the person has to accept the fact that they might be embarrassed. We all are, unless you're, I don't know. I guess if you're a hermit, I think I'm above the curve because I embarrass myself in public constantly. But I think everyone gets embarrassed at times. And people, when they're anxious, might show that they're anxious. And as long as that's a horrible thing that you have to avoid, you're going to be focused on it, and it's going to make it inadvertently worse. And if you can accept that, yes, things happen. Not everybody. I like to talk about the fact that, well, I'll get to that in intervention, but there is no way, I am convinced, just like I can't guarantee that anyone, any panic disorder patient will never have another panic attack, because I can't guarantee that anyone in the population won't have a panic attack. Similarly, I can't guarantee that someone will never embarrass themselves. I mean, we're human. We can embarrass ourselves, and not everyone's going to like us. There is nothing you can do to make sure everyone will like you. And in fact, the people who seem perfect, in general, get worse ratings in terms of liking, because all of us are kind of self-conscious to be around someone who seems too perfect. You can't win. You're not going to get everyone to like you, and you're not going to be so cool and calm and sophisticated that you're never embarrassed. But accepting that is not an easy sell. But that is, it's just as huge with social anxiety disorder as it is with panic disorder. Acceptance is just huge. So now we've got similarly with the other anxiety disorders, we have the physiologic piece, the cognitive piece, and the behavioral piece. Now, physiologically, okay, quite similar. Medications can be used. Inderol is interesting. Inderol is a beta blocker. It's designed for treating heart issues, okay? But it has the side effect of reducing peripheral symptoms for some people. And it's quick. It's like you don't have to take it for 6 weeks, okay? So there are some performers, there are a lot of performers, athletes, you name it, with social anxiety disorder. There are some people who can take an Inderol before a performance, and it's fast acting if their symptoms happen to match the symptoms. So if shaking and heart racing are part of the package, they can take their Inderol and they don't have the symptoms. Now, if it actually works for them, they're not going to come see you because they're doing fine. However, Marilyn was an example of that. Her doc gave her Inderol. It helped for a while, but she was still avoiding. See, the thing is, you can't accept, same thing, you can't accept the possibility of being embarrassed and move on as long as you're thinking, okay, am I anxious enough to take this pill? So what happened? Yeah, it helped at first, but she was trying to fight and avoid the feelings of anxiety, so actually it started to grow and generalize until she couldn't even sit one-on-one with a person that she thought was an authority figure. So there's another catch to the beta blockers, the Inderol and other beta blockers, and that is that one of the most common side effects is depression. Well, people with anxiety disorders often get depressed as a result of their anxiety disorder. And I have had patients who have come in for depression where the entire treatment involved doing a good evaluation, finding out that their depression co-occurred with starting to take a beta blocker, talking to their physician, and changing their beta blocker. And poof, no more depression. So you got to be careful, because the last thing people with social anxiety disorder need is help being more depressed. So if there, you know, I am absolutely, as with the benzos, the tranquilizers, I don't think there's a way. Again, if a person takes does one concert a year, they take some Inderol beforehand and it works for them, fine. Who am I? I don't have to be self-righteous about it. If it works for them, it works for them. But if they're giving regular, they're getting anxious on a regular basis, they're taking the Inderol to ward off the evil anxiety, they're focusing on it, they're saying, oh, I hope the Inderol works, what if it doesn't? It's going to get worse. And so I can't endorse any kind of PRN medication. Now, another problem with social anxiety disorder, if you think of the older gentleman in this in the video, one of the things about social anxiety disorder is it's pretty 50-50 gender-wise in population studies, so which is unusual. Most mental health disorders, more women report the problem, more women report panic disorder, but with social anxiety disorder, it's pretty 50-50. And the reason, in a lot of cultures, it's still expected that the man will take the initiative in terms of dating. And what happens is you get a lot of men, middle-aged men, who feel isolated, alone, depressed, because they've wanted relationships. They look around, everyone seems happy. They don't know the truth that all those people in relationships are not necessarily happy, but they look around and everyone is in couples and everyone's happy. So what if you think about the demographic, middle-aged men, isolated, alone, depressed, what else might we have to worry about?
Suicide.
Yeah. And boy, be careful assessing suicidality in social anxiety disorder. Back when I was young and stupid, which you may have noticed I have many examples of this, we really thought of social phobia as fear of public speaking. And when they first started having studies showing a connection with suicidality, we were like, what? People really get suicidal over public speaking? And then, as we read on, I mean, it's like, yeah, not the public speaking, but the generalized social anxiety disorder, be very careful about suicidality. These people have been watching the rest of the world doing something they desperately want, and they can't get themselves, they can't bring themselves to do. And so they're often isolated and alone, and spending hours and hours and hours by themselves and with lots of time to think about how isolated and alone they are. And so be very careful to assess suicidality. And it can be a huge, huge problem. And another assessment thing that I didn't mention is the difference between schizoid people and social anxiety disorder people, and especially, and we'll get to avoidant personality later, which is, can be a lot of overlap. Certainly, there are lots of people with social anxiety disorders who aren't avoidant personality, but most avoidant personality disorders patients have social anxiety disorder because they want relationships. And they're terrified. The schizoids, they don't get it. Why would you want that? Mm-hmm. You know, they'll say, and you can tell. I mean, I use my body as a, you know, after you've worked with enough people, you can just keep talking to someone. When you talk to someone with social anxiety disorder, they might be really nervous talking to you because, you know, you're, by definition, they're already in a social situation, right? But they want it. They want to connect. And they're very, very upset that they can't. And this is especially for the generalized social anxiety disorder people. The schizoids, there's nothing there. You don't feel a connection. I mean, it's totally different kind of talking. My heart goes out to the social anxiety disorder people. I mean, they try so hard, and they're doing often everything wrong by avoiding and building their life around and not, you know, being afraid to try. My heart goes out to them. The schizoids, they'll say things like, you know, well, you know, it might be nice to have sex once in a while, but that's all the only reason I can think of why you'd want to deal with people, you know. And again, on the surface, somebody who's socially anxious might take a job at night in a storeroom or with, you know, filing where they don't have to deal with people, and a schizoid might do the same thing. But the presentation is very different, and when you get, you know, talk about their thoughts and feelings, it becomes very, very clear. But do be careful, because you sure don't want to be treating someone who's schizoid as if they were socially anxious, or vice versa. So relaxation certainly could be used. A lot of people, you know, so back to the physiological, a lot of people use alcohol, and you can tell right away if they're gonna likely to get in trouble if they tell you, well, I have to have a few drinks before I go on a date, or I have to have a few drinks before I go out. And then you can see that it grows and grows. You know, that is a different kind of avoidance. There is, again, no way to use any kind of PRN relaxant without avoiding, including if the person's really, really anxious and can't sit to talk to you, okay, relaxation training might, or meditation might be useful, but never, never, never I have to do my relaxation training before I go out in public. That's setting up the expectation, this is a, you know, weapon, it's going to protect me from the evil anxiety. Just, that's no different than having a good stiff drink or taking some Xanax before you go out. It's avoiding dealing with the feelings. And it sets up, and with exposure. And our studies have shown that if you do exposure in an altered state, it doesn't generalize to normal day-to-day. So that right there is a sign. If a person has to drink or smoke pot or take a tranquilizer before going in social situations, that's, you know, you want to get their cognitions, but it's a pretty clear sign that we're talking about social anxiety disorder. So now, SSRIs can be helpful. The difference is you take your SSRI, which is an antidepressant, but it has been shown to help with social anxiety disorder. You take it the same time every day. You take it whether you're going out or you're not going out. It's like me taking my vitamin D. Big deal. Okay, that's fine. You can still accept, you can deal, you can expose, you can do everything. So, fine. If it turns out that that's helpful to them, and it doesn't cause other side effects. One problem with social anxiety disorder and the SSRIs is that they all, no matter what the drug reps tell you, they all have sexual side effects. They all affect sexual desire and sexual performance. So that can cause a problem, because of course, as you can imagine, if a person with social anxiety disorder actually gets to the point of being engaged in a sexual interaction and then they cannot perform, well, that really helps calm them down. Not. So Amy, when we think about the recovering alcoholic, her AA group was absolutely drug and anti-drug, any kind of drugs. So she wanted to be drug-free. I mean, they didn't believe in vitamins. And Marilyn had really seen that the Interol wasn't helping, after a while. So, and John had never, something as specific as anxiety when using a public restroom, if you're in the restaurant, go in the restroom. Medications aren't really designed for that. So they all wanted to be off of medications. So that's the physiologic. Okay. The cognitive, you need to understand what the person is really, which piece of social exposure they're anxious about. So this first thought sheet on page 15 is from Marilyn. Now, anxious patients are much less aware and insightful about their cognitions than depressed patients. This has been across the board with anxiety. Marilyn swore to me she was only anxious speaking in business situations where it could affect her career. So we decided she would start, practicing, going, and she wanted to practice in a place that felt safe. She had had, actually, it was her first husband that was, her first husband had been an alcoholic. She was currently in another marriage, and he was not alcoholic. But she had found, back with her first husband, she found Al-Anon to be a safe place. And so she was interested and willing to practice there. And she was, so no work people, nothing, right? So here, look. This is her early thought sheet. She's anxious 90%. So much for the self-report that it was only in work situations. Okay? And this is often, I'm not saying she was lying. It's just that's how she formulated it, but she hadn't been in situations where you had to speak in public at other places. So here's her early thought sheet. She's very, very anxious, and her thought is, I won't be able to speak. And her response is, I will be able to speak. I won't make any sense. I should make sense. This is, I'm going to reward her. She's pinpointing some thoughts. She's looking at her thoughts. But obviously, just going, I won't, I will, is not a very useful type of responding. And with anxiety, when we're looking at responding, we're looking at responses that enhance acceptance. Not, well, I'm going to die, no, I won't die. That's not going to be convincing. It's about the avoidance, it's about accepting. So later, we helped gently with lots of reward, helped her on page 16. She was at a large staff meeting and had the thoughts, I'll sound nervous and they'll think I don't know what I'm doing. And she could respond, wait, anxiety is normal. I can breathe slowly. I can speak slowly. I don't know what people will think. And how much do I really care? I know what I'm doing. And if someone doesn't think so, that's their opinion. Okay? I won't be able to finish my sentence. That was one of her biggest fears, is that she would freeze. And so, exposure. I can just say, I lost my train of thought. I will feel really anxious. And the response is, okay, I can tolerate that. And she got down to, I won't seem as perfect as they think I am. Now, I'm willing to bet that the people really didn't think she was perfect, okay? But it was important to her that they think she was perfect. And we needed to really grapple with, she's not perfect. She doesn't really need to be. Life will go on if they know she's not perfect. In fact, people like people better when they're not perfect. But it's hard for people who are stuck in perfectionism to see that. Another example is of Amy. So she was at going to tea. Now, this is gutsy. And here's the thing also about social anxiety disorder. It is almost impossible to do true graded exposure because life interferes. So Marilyn wanted to start with a small meeting and build, then they called a large staff meeting. Right? You know, you want to do a baby step, and then all of a sudden, so Amy was invited to tea, of all things, at Arabica, which I think is no longer here, but was a wonderful place with really good coffees and teas, and Leah happened to be her ex. Okay, so, I mean, heavy-weighted situation with tea, of all things. Okay, so she's like, oh, no, Leah's here. I had this big glass of tea. I'm going to shake. I won't be able to drink it. Will she notice? I'm so uncomfortable. But she was able to think it through. Okay, I need to be uncomfortable right now. I can take it. I can stand to be uncomfortable. People really don't pay that much attention to how I drink. There's nothing wrong with shaking. If I shake, I shake. People really couldn't care less whether I shake or not. And I actually don't shake that much. I worry about it more than I actually do. And this is how you want to use the thought sheet. It's not about I'll shake, I won't shake, or I'll block, I won't block. It's like, you know what? If the thing I'm afraid of happens, I will deal with it. I may not like it, but I will deal with it. I can accept the fact that I might get anxious, and I'm willing to deal with it. And that is how we want to use the thought sheet. Not, you'll be fine, you won't get anxious. That's a setup. Just tell someone, you'll be fine, you won't get anxious. That's a challenge. I mean, it's like, no, it's a, and again, when we get to the exposure part, we want anxiety. Anxiety is important to accepting. You can say, oh, yeah, it's fine if I get embarrassed. The proof's in the pudding. Okay, if you're sure you'll be fine, maybe we need to practice it. So in challenging the thoughts, we need to validate their feelings. Never, ever with anxiety. Believe me, every anxiety disorder you see, the person is as frightened as you would be if someone put a gun to your head. I mean, really, this is scary stuff. It's very real to them. You could say, well, like, who cares? I mean, if you do it like that, if you're challenging and you go, so who cares if you shake? You've lost them because you're showing that you don't get it. They care deeply. We need to help them get to the point where they can say, okay, it feels very important, but it's not worth what I'm going through to try to avoid it. I'm willing to accept the feeling. I can deal with the feeling. So you're going to validate, but then look at what's the conclusion. Yes, you might feel anxious. You might shake. So here's a... You can do all kinds of good things. You can do the downward arrow. You can do do all kinds of things to challenge assumptions. But here's a pie chart, you know. Okay, if somebody sees your hand shaking, what are the possible reasons? What might they think? I would rate not noticing much higher. Most people are not going to notice. No, people aren't scrutinizing. For Pete's sake, you could have Parkinson's. What are you going to do, laugh at somebody who has Parkinson's? I know a lot of people with Parkinson's. People aren't going to say, what? You're shaking. Do you have Parkinson's? I mean, if they do, then, you know, be prepared. If they do, that tells you a lot about them. But they might think all kinds of things. They might think you've got the flu, you're nervous, yes. Incompetent, possible. Being an addict, sure, they might. They can draw any conclusions they want. And there are a bunch of possible, and you can't tell what the other person's thinking unless they tell you. You're not going to know? And if they do, then we look at, okay, if they do notice, and what if they do think you're incompetent? How bad is that? What will actually happen? And I have seen, you know, who have a lot of people with really bad social anxiety disorders. I see a disproportionate, so I don't know of any studies showing, but I think that there's a higher percentage among drug reps. I don't know if you know about the world of drug reps in our society, at least in Western society. there is so much pressure. It is unbelievable. They have to go to these conferences, and there's a room of 500 people, and they will call you up in front of 500 people, and you're going to role play. There's a doctor, and you're going to sell this drug to them. And, I mean, the stress is incredible. It pays really well, but it is a high stress. Sale, sale, sale. It's all in the computer. How much did your doc that you're in your territory, how many Xanax did he prescribe? And boy, if he's not prescribing enough Xanax, it's high pressure. So these people have a lot of anxiety about presentations. And you know what? When we actually look at it and look at what will happen if they notice I'm anxious, actually, my patients with social anxiety, my drug reps that I've seen over the years, and a bunch of them I have long-term follow-up on, they win prizes. They win exotic vacation cruises. They sell great. Even with accepting the possibility of anxiety, and probably because they're accepting the possibility of anxiety. By the way, yes, here again, has one of them taken me on one of those trips? No. I couldn't go anyway because of ethics, but have they asked? Have they offered? No. Okay. Look, I mean, yeah, I'm fine with it. I'm working on my cognitions. I have no feelings about this whatsoever. But when people, and they will, they'll say, you don't understand. In my profession, you can't show any weakness. In my profession, you have to always be calm, cool, and collected. And that is something you're going to have to help them really look at. Because A, is being vigilant and worrying about it helping them to be calm, cool, and collected? Or is it making it worse? And do they really have data to show that being themselves and demonstrating some imperfections or some anxiety is really going to cost them their jobs? I have one great a prosecuting attorney, you know, an attorney who has to go up and talk to the jury, all kinds of people in high stress jobs, huge social anxiety disorder. I saw him many, many years ago. He came back, and you know, I always wonder, did he go down here? He came back for a totally different reason. He was absolutely fine with his anxiety. You don't buy into their, in this case, you really have to be. Because the truth is, when people are human, everybody likes you better. And did I tell you about my professor's study about spilling the water? Did I already give that anecdote? So there's a whole line of research about this. And then we'll take the first break because we're talking about bathrooms, not a good thing. Whole line of research, old now, but very consistent. If you have somebody presenting a talk and does it perfectly, and you get evaluations from all the audience. Same person, same talk, but in the middle of the talk, they knock over their water glass. Okay? Evaluations. Guess which one got higher evaluations on like every point? How much did you learn? How much did you like him? How engaging was he?
The one who knocked him over.
Mm-hmm. The one who knocked over the water got much better evaluations. And this is a finding that's shown up, it's been very consistent. Personally, I remember, again, in college, I remember there was a guy, we used to call him, we were not very nice in college. I was not only stupid, but I wasn't very nice. We would call him Mr. Every Hair in Place. Okay, he always looked perfect. He always he was just always presented himself. He was totally put together, very preppy. But, you know, and he knew what he was talking. It wasn't just looks, you know. He was always Mr. Perfect. And we hated him. I mean, I'm sure there's somebody out there for everybody, so I'm sure somebody liked him. But in general, we kind of like human beings. We kind of like a little, give me a, you know, give me a, you know. a little flaw. I personally like, you might understand this, I kind of like the absent-minded professor flaw, so that's how I ended up with Jim. He could be a little dingy, and that's okay, it's kind of endearing. People like human, but with people with social anxiety, really are you know, you have to help them. You can't just lecture them. You have to help them examine that, because they're setting themselves up. For, you know, if I have to be perfect, and they will try to convince you that in their case it's true. And you know what? I don't buy it. But what I think isn't what's important, you've got to help them to really look at how's it working the way they're doing it, and is it worth trying it a little different. I'm going to mix things up just to shake things up. We're going to take a 6-minute break. And then we're going to move to role plays, because they're going to be about OCD. And then we'll finish up so we don't script on the role plays, which sometimes happens. So.